Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of October 5th, 2017. Today we're joined by our frequent guest and prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well.
Good,
how are you
doing? Glad to have you aboard. So, D.R., anyone who listens to the news is probably fully apprised and does not need any explanation or further exposition information from us about the events in Las Vegas. We, of course, extend our deepest condolence to the people who are suffering, the city, and indeed the whole country. That is a terrible event, terrible event, of which I think most people listening to this podcast are aware that there's a relatively some simple steps that could be taken to try and avoid these things in the future. But really, I guess there's a different angle that I would like to discuss as regards the shootings in Las Vegas. And that is, I suppose it's a discussion of the process or the procedure, maybe you say is a better word, the procedure that the country now has when we have one of these horrific events. And that includes empty thoughts and prayers for the victim, and then generally speaking, several statements that say it's too soon to discuss any sort of politicization, any sort of bills that might address the kinds of issues around Las Vegas. And of course, it occurred to me that in parallel, we have heard the administrator of the EPA stand up and say that it was too soon to talk about climate change after Hurricane Irma. There were still victims suffering, and that we couldn't discuss climate change because that would just be inhumane. And then you have the whole question of, it seems to me, the Colin Kaepernick take a knee issue, which is this sort of resentful response that says, it's why are you bringing this topic into our nice little football game? Why don't you just leave things alone? I guess, did you see anything to that effect, DR, just to set the stage? I mean, that's a topic that I think is ripe for evaluation. Do you agree?
Yes. So obviously, the White House spokesman, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, basically saying, you know, it's too soon to speculate about gun violence and gun control in the wake of this massacre in Las Vegas. And it reminds me of something that climate scientist Michael Mann has discussed. He calls it the Sandy Silence Doctrine. And he makes reference to two incidents in 2012 where you had Superstorm Sandy, where on the heels of that, people said, well, it's too soon to talk about climate change. And then the Sandy Hook shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, where people said right afterwards, it's too soon to talk about gun violence. So in other words, people try to have, if you will, a delay of game in discussing the causes of certain horrors in society. And therefore, they basically try to run out the clock, so to speak, so that we never have a discussion and never have action to try to solve the problems that are created by inaction.
So you've said it well. And I guess the question before us is, from a climate perspective, from the climate hawks perspective, or maybe from a progressive perspective, we know there's going to be another climate event. Right, where people say the same things. I guess the question is, how do we approach it? How do you respond? How do you understand the impulse of the other side to try and push this stuff down? I mean, so let me ask, let's just stay on that for a minute. Do you think that Sarah Huckabee Sanders is consciously trying to delay the conversation by sort of cynically delaying any kind of conversation about gun control and just using this as an excuse? Or do you think that she truly is concerned that she will offend, I don't know, I mean, who? I mean, I'm sure the people in Las Vegas are not listening to her press conference. I mean, what do you make of the motivation of the people who say these things? And how does it spread? And the real issue is, how is it going to spread across how a climate hawk should react in the future, right?
Well, it's basically an arrogant way of responding, basically saying that somebody who doesn't want to talk about the issue essentially doesn't care about solving the problem, and they prefer to sweep the problem under the rug. And what you have to do is you have to pull the rug away and show the dirt, and basically say, yes, it is time to discuss these issues.
Yeah, I mean, I of course I agree with you. I think that this idea that people, Scott Pruitt, didn't want to talk about climate change, not because the people of Florida were suffering, but because he didn't want to talk about climate change. I mean, for those guys, it's pretty clear cut. And I would say probably the same thing is true for NRA types. They don't want to discuss this, but I kind of put this whole thing in the category of I'm not sure what the right word is, but it's privilege of the well-placed, right? Most people think they don't have to worry about climate change or being stopped by a policeman or, you know, being shot at a conference, right? So they somehow don't want to be disturbed by the harsh reality of their fellow Americans, and they are resentful that their complacency and happiness is disturbed. Is that, I mean, does that make sense?
Yes, I've heard the term failure of imagination to describe this phenomenon when somebody cannot imagine what it's like to be in another person's shoes. I think about a very controversial film from years ago, Twilight Zone, the movie. If you remember that segment with Vic Morrow, and obviously it's controversial because Vic Morrow passed away during the filming of this segment, it was about this bigoted person who all of a sudden realizes what it's like to be a person of color, what it's like to be a Jew in Nazi Germany, what it's like to be dispossessed, what it's like to be disadvantaged, and with, you know, with the overall theme of the segment being, you know, that's the only way some people can understand being oppressed is to basically be in the group that is being held down, that is being oppressed, and otherwise people won't get it at all.
So you think it's an empathy issue?
Absolutely, absolutely. People, you know, if it's somebody's family member or somebody's relative or somebody's, you know, loved one that suffers as a result of this, all of a sudden they have a very, very different perspective. You know, the example that's been brought up so many times, it's a cliche, is former Vice President Cheney supporting marriage equality only because his daughter was gay, whereas otherwise he would not have given
a damn. Right. The same with Senator Portman, I guess, from Ohio, one of those states out there. Right? His son was gay, and that, well, yeah, it's, and I guess, I mean, we have an example up close in the tragedy in Las Vegas. I guess there was well-known country singing personality who had a bit of a change of heart after he participated in that, was part of that event. And God bless him. I mean, I'm happy to have people kind of see the light, but I guess it points out the irony of all the other people that, I mean, I saw somewhere actually that this thing in Las Vegas has put kind of a crack into the wall of country music, and of course I know not very much about it, so I have to tread carefully, but that somehow all of a sudden people are kind of scratching their head saying, you know, this, how could this have happened to us? You know, is there some way to prevent it? Whereas in the past it was always somebody else that was getting shot at, right?
Mm-hmm. So indeed, that people who don't expect to be the ones who suffer. It's like when you watch the nightly news and you hear about some sort of, you know, brutal, you know, event, a murder, suicide, a mass shooting, and somebody is always quoted as saying, "We never thought it would happen in our neighborhood."
Right. Well, this is the guy.
So, you know, they always assumed it would happen in another neighborhood, not their own.
So that leads us to a second discussion that I think is useful to have, and this relates to the question of, well, the precursor is that during the 1960s, when Martin Luther King was leading the March on Washington, that was not above 50% of public approval. I mean, most people thought it was a bad thing to do. Right now we have Colin Kaepernick and the Take a Knee movement, which many people think is not a good thing to do. But the bottom line point is that protest in action is by definition unpopular, right? If you had a popular thing, you wouldn't have to protest it. It's always the sort of underdog that's making the protest. That leads us to the question of a guy named Bill McKibben, who has on multiple occasions staked out somewhat, positioned somewhat ahead of the curve, right? I mean, he's the one who set up the discussion of keeping the fossil fuels in the ground, of divestiture, all these things, which generally speaking are not well accepted initially, except by, you know, the climate hawk types, but then take on over the course of time, move to the middle and become a accepted thing. I mean, I think I saw an article, maybe you saw it, DR, that there were 40, some significant fraction of the Catholic Church dioceses here in America are going to divest of fossil fuel or something. Did you see that?
Yes, I saw something. I saw something.
Right. So here, Bill McKibben's way out, somewhat crazy idea has moved to the mainstream, where colleges across the country are doing something which is admittedly symbolic, but it nonetheless changes the discussion. So I guess the question at hand, DR, is, this is an article, as we said, by Dave Roberts in Vox. I mean, what strategy should climate hawks take in terms of proposing what would appear to be outlandish proposals, like 100% clean energy, do everything now, rebuild Puerto Rico as a completely green economy? Is that wise? Does that alienate people, or does that create a movement to the center where the idea becomes a commonplace? I mean, what's your take on it?
What goes to the whole idea of moving the Overton window, that if you take a position in what is perceived to be an extreme direction, and another entity takes a position to the other extreme, in order to have some resolution to the issue, you compromise at a certain midpoint. So if you stake out a position that goes to sort of 100% moving away from fossil fuels, and the other side doesn't want to do that, at some point you get closer to some portion of moving away from fossil fuels, and that's a way of moving the Overton window in a more forward-thinking direction.
Right. You mean the Overton window being the list of acceptable discussion points, or things that can be spoken of in political terms without being laughed at, right?
Exactly.
But do you think if I remember correctly, the article pointed out there are instances where it kind of backfires, and you by staking out an extreme position on something, right? Then the great moderate middle, where you imagine deals are cut, they get tarnished with as being too extreme for the rest of the population. Do you think that's a possible scenario?
Yes, and as David Roberts cites in his piece on the study of McKibben, they contrasted with Naomi Klein's argument about capitalism being the driver of the climate crisis, and they basically say that, you know, that is essentially so beyond the Overton window. It's a position that where you cannot move the Overton window, because who is going to compromise in terms of any sort of movement away from capitalism, at least in the United States, it's highly unlikely. So McKibben's proposals are, you know, quote unquote radical within the realm of the possible, and Klein's proposals are not, according to this analysis.
Uh-huh. Although, you know, that's what they told Karl Marx, right? Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting topic, because in this day and age, I mean, the proposal for single-payer health care seems to have moved to the middle, right? Or all of a sudden, that's we can all talk about single-payer with a straight face, and Bernie's out there, and many of the Democrats are climbing onto it. And why? It's because someone was brave enough to talk about the issue and point it out, even when it seemed unpopular. I guess the take-home lesson is for climate hawks is that we should not, well, at least for me, right? You can argue strategy all you want, but at least for me, the idea that we should demand what seem to be pipe dream kind of proposals. That is to say, the United States say 100% off clean energy by 2030 or something like that. That changes the conversation in a good way, I think.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, although, as Roberts points out, the question is how do you translate certain things into policy? And going back to a point we've made before, the idea that you can solve the crisis by, trying to limit growth. How do you translate calling for a limit on growth into politics? That is the that's the toughest nut to crack.
No, I agree. It's I mean, and I think that the genius, I would say, of McKibben is that all his proposals, as you say, are sort of within the possible, but they don't head-on confront the Naomi Klein call that says, oh, yeah, capitalism's incompatible with the future, right? I think that you talk about single-payer health care. I mean, if somebody were listening to this would think you were strategizing communism, but, I mean, basically, Americans love socialism when it's for them, right? So single-payer health care, getting a rebate on your energy bill. I mean, those are all things that are appealing to people as long as it's not cast into this communist and capitalist framework, right?
So socialism for me, but
yes,
not for thee.
Yes. Well, DR, we got to leave it there. I think that between the two take-home lessons are that it is never too early to begin discussing the political fallout from major shocking events, as we've just seen in Las Vegas, as we've just seen in Puerto Rico. Of course, we have to talk about Puerto Rico at some point, but the all those things, it's not too soon. And we shouldn't be cowed from pointing out the political implications of these straightforward, obvious things. And the second is that we should not, as climate hawks, not be afraid to call for bold and challenging policies, because only that way do we get to have the discussion and those things become acceptable, even though they may start out on the fringes of acceptability. So that's the pronouncement for the week, DR. That's the political science lesson. We'll try to put up...
Today's radicalism is tomorrow's mainstream.
Exactly. We'll put up some links to some of the stuff we talked about at the blog. It'll be at massclimateaction.org/blog. Of course, you can find this show on Facebook at /massclimateaction. Please share us with your friends. You can listen to the show directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud. On all those directories, if you recommend us, vote us up. It's good for the distribution of the show. You can also find us on iTunes if you search for Massachusetts Climate Action. So we'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, DR. Hey, thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.